This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with my fabulous coworker, Pat Brisbane. So you're here because you have been writing a book on Haskell.
I am. I feel like I'm on a talk show promoting something.
You are. You're doing you're doing a book tour
right now.
That's
pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's it called?
It is called Maybe Haskell. Mm-hmm. It's a beginner book for, you know, people interested in Haskell. Doesn't assume any Haskell knowledge and sort of walks you through just enough Haskell to talk about something that I think is interesting but is still sort of at the simpler end of the spectrum, so a little more palatable, which is the maybe data type, which is how Haskell deals with not having nulls or nils in the language.
So you have a function that could return a value, but sometimes there's not a valid value to return.
Exactly.
Like you're looking up a user in the database by ID, and sometimes there's a user and sometimes there's not.
Right.
So in Ruby, we typically return nil in those cases.
And that just destroys your life.
Yeah, it does. It's one of those things that tends to like kind of go viral throughout the system, right?
Yep.
Like the method that calls the method that calls the method that returns nil, they all need to guard for that.
Yep. You either have to have all these nil checks or you end up with a production exception that's like miles away from where the actual source of the problem is.
Right, which is really insidious.
Which is the best. So Haskell's solution, not having a nil to sort of take the easy way out, is to change the return type of such an expression. So instead of find user returning a user, it actually returns a maybe user. And a maybe user can either be just the user or it can be nothing. And at first, it kind of sounds like nothing is the same thing as nil. So like, what's the big deal? But it's actually not a lot more powerful than that. You can see in the type system that this function returns a maybe value. So you know that there's a chance that that user might not be there. And you're forced to handle both cases, either the just user or the nothing.
Right. That's the first benefit, is you can't forget.
Right.
It's easy to forget or not even know in the first place. Like, oh, this thing can return a nil sometimes. I have to handle this.
Exactly. And then the flip side of that is that when you have expressions or values that aren't of type maybe, that are type user, you can be 100% confident that it's there. And you don't have to worry about exceptions from trying to access it when it's not really there.
Yeah. And then the nice thing that you sort of get to when you have this data type is that you have functions in the system that operate on the value of user.
Yep.
And they don't care that the fact that sometimes it's not going to be there. Like you can sort of shield them from this reality.
Yep.
And then you can have the functions that need to care about this can care.
Yep. And then you have sort of convenient higher level abstractions to make it very easy to take functions that operate on users and sort of promote them into functions that operate on maybe users. And that's one of the first things I talk about called functor, which is, you know, one of those scary category theory things that is actually not terribly complicated and just makes your life a lot better.
Yeah, so I really like this approach overall. It was interesting because you took this idea and with this idea, it lets you bump into a handful of like interesting things in Haskell. But it wasn't like, here's a book to teach you all of Haskell.
Right.
It was like, here are the rudiments, and then we're going to explore this kind of interesting area of the language that will kind of let us almost accidentally bump into these interesting ideas.
Yeah, that was definitely the idea, because if you aim to write a book to teach someone all of Haskell, first of all, I don't feel qualified to do it. And secondly, it's going to be a huge book. And a lot of people sort of drop out as they get into it, because it's a very deep topic, which is why I like it. And I wanted to provide something that would get people hooked. So sort of go beyond the level of, you know, clever tweets, but not so far as in you have to invest a whole lot of time.
Yeah. It's kind of a nice happy medium because the book is pretty approachable. It's like 70 pages or something like that.
Yeah. It's definitely short.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm almost done reading it for the second time because I've been reviewing it. And so it's nice to have something that you feel is digestible.
Yes.
It's interesting. So I've seen this a lot in Vim, which is certain things in programming, or I guess every in the world, have like this sort of myth of being very complicated or hard to learn. And sometimes that's true, but like they tend to get blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
So people, I found that with Vim, over exaggerate how hard it is to learn.
Yeah.
And I think a similar thing happens to Haskell.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I mean, for the longest time, it was created by and worked on by academics doing programming language theory. So most of the literature out there sort of had that paper academic feel to it. And there really wasn't any interest in making it a popular language, which I think is great because they could make decisions that resulted in what we have today, which is a very principled and safe language that, you know, didn't take any shortcuts, which I think is awesome. But that did kind of, you know, at least partially lead to a language that people are sort of afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of put it on this pedestal that it's, you know, it is deep, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't necessarily call it hard.
Mm-hmm. And it has a number of things that are unfamiliar.
Yes.
And it's kind of that easy versus simple thing where, like, it has things that you probably have not heard of before. And the words sound kind of scary, like
right.
functor and applicative. Like, these sound like scary topics, but in fact are, like, fairly understandable things when you get into
yeah.
them. And if
yeah.
you sort of allow yourself to feel that, like, wow, this seems a little scary, but I'm going to try to learn it anyway, like,
yeah.
has been important to me.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, this seems weird and foreign, but I'm just going to press forward and, like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. This is just, like, not that bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I see a lot when people are learning and thinking about Haskell, there's a danger of mistaking unfamiliarity with unreadability
mm-hmm.
and mistaking different with difficult.
Totally.
That's why I think people that come to Haskell first and have no object-oriented background have a much better time
mm-hmm.
than people that need to sort of unlearn a lot of what they already have.
Totally. So what was your writing process like?
Well, it started actually as a blog series. I wrote maybe 5 articles focused around maybe and submitted them as a PR to the blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Caleb probably who has been sort of trying to jumpstart or re-jumpstart our book mm-hmm. area, asked me if I would do it as a book. So mm-hmm. I said, sure. So I had a lot of material already ready. I just had to convert it into paperback format, which is the tool that we use to author the various formats.
That explains why you got it done so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it was already taken care of. And luckily I had some breaks between client projects.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably... The blog post I sort of wrote on Fridays, maybe 2 or 3 Fridays,
mm-hmm.
and then I had a 2-week period between client projects that I got most of the content done,
yep.
and then these past 2 or 3 weeks have been another break where I was able to sort of push it the rest of the way.
Did you start at the beginning and then work your way towards the end?
I sort of started in the middle. I had sort of the heart of the book, which is the description of the maybe data type, and then the other concepts, the functor and applicative and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and then I sort of wrote the introduction and the Haskell basics after that, and then came back to do the ending, which is some other data types that are similar and interesting.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to me to see different parts of the book. It feels kind of like you hit your stride mm-hmm. in certain sections, and so, like, some of them feel a little more awkward, and some of them feel like, yeah, like you knew what you were going to say, and like you said it well here.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely some difficulty when I had a lot of material that I was really, I don't know how to put it. I knew what I wanted to say going into it, and so I was able to say it really well. But then there was other material that I sort of needed to add to make it feel complete,
yep.
But didn't come out as well because it just wasn't, you know, as purposeful, I guess.
Mm. It was striking to me, the first section of the book was like an introduction to Haskell, like Haskell fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you're pretty far from a Haskell beginner.
Yeah, so that's hard.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to go back and write those intro sections and to know what you're not explaining.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's why, like, I think I have more notes on that chapter than anything else, is because yeah. it's like I was new to Haskell at that point, and so it's like everything was like, what is this? What is this? What is this?
Yeah, and that feedback was absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
Because you know, I would just be guessing at like what's necessary to go deeper and what's necessary to not. So having those "what is this" notes was perfect, because I could just go in and, you know, turn that sentence into a paragraph.
Right.
And now it's that much better.
Totally. Yeah. Well, if you have an acknowledgments page, I mean, there's some people you could put on there. So just at a high level, so what does the book cover? We talk about functors and...
Yep. So we start with the maybe data type,
mm-hmm.
and then we show how it has the correct interface to be called a functor.
So we maybe have not explained, I guess we did kind of explain maybe, but
a
maybe
little
just
bit.
Go a little bit more into maybe. Like, what is the maybe data type?
Right. So it's in Haskell, data types can have multiple constructors, which is multiple ways to build a value of that type.
Yep.
So maybe has 2 constructors. It has the just constructor, which takes an actual value and
mm-hmm.
gives you a maybe value, which
mm-hmm.
happens to be there. And it also has the nothing constructor, which you don't give it a value because nothing's there.
Right.
But what you still get back is a maybe thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to not be there.
Right.
So once you have this maybe thing, you can pass that around, and then you can use another thing called pattern matching to basically inspect how was this value constructed. If it was constructed with just, then I get that user and I can do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
If it was constructed with nothing, then I also have to handle that case.
So like if you think of maybe user,
mm-hmm.
you sort of have 2 pieces, which is sort of like you have the user itself and mm-hmm. then this context of this may or may not be there.
Right.
And so if you have a just user, that means this thing is there,
mm-hmm.
and here's you can get the user out whenever you want.
Right.
If you have nothing, it's like this thing was not there.
Yeah,
they both kind of fall under this maybe type.
Right, and this that's actually a really good point. This idea that the maybe user represents two pieces of information mm-hmm. is sort of the generic idea that you can take to other types.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I go through either and list and IO and things like that. And those are other types that also hold two pieces of information.
Mm-hmm.
So a list is a good example. You have this list of A's. You have, or I'll make it concrete, a list of users.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you that you have a user. It also tells you that you have many users, and it tells you exactly how many users.
Mm-hmm.
The list is that other piece of information, the length.
Yep.
So that's the maybe data type.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talk about how it's a functor, which are things that you can map over.
Mm-hmm. So functor is a scary word, but it kind of just means like mappable, right?
That's one way to think about it, yeah. Functor, applicative, and monad are all interfaces. So if you think about, you know, in Ruby, you have enumerable or comparable.
Mm-hmm.
Numeric is another way to think about it. So multiple types can be numbers, integers, rationals, floats. They can all be numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple types can be functors.
Right.
Lists can be functors. Maybe can be functors, things like that.
So it basically says, to be a functor, I have to implement a certain function
mm-hmm.
with a certain type signature.
Yep.
And then obey these certain laws to
yep.
behave well.
Exactly.
And then I can say, I'm a functor. And anything mm-hmm. that expects a functor can use me in that way.
Exactly.
Cool. So it's kind of like normal programming interfaces or protocols yep. or things like that.
Exactly.
Gotcha. And applicative and monad are also just the same thing.
It's the same type of construct.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So functor is the simplest. It has a function called fmap, which basically means if I have a function that goes from A to B, how do I make a function that goes from maybe A to maybe B?
Mm-hmm.
So that allows you to take these functions in your system that work on users that are actually there, and you just give that function to fmap, and you get back a function that works on maybe users,
mm-hmm.
Which is super convenient.
And it's nice that it's kind of a beautiful division of working on concrete values and being aware of the fact that the value might not be there.
Yeah.
Like, it lets you keep those separate.
Totally.
Like, you don't have those checks in your functions that work on users, but you can promote them into a thing that takes a maybe mm-hmm. user, but in a sort of separate conceptual space.
Right, right. So Haskell lets you have these types that hold two pieces of information, which is nice. And it also lets you completely separately either operate on that other piece of information or operate on that value itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you write functions that can operate on users, and you write a function called fmap that knows how to deal with this other piece of information, whether it's there or not. And then you put those two together to actually operate on a maybe value.
Okay. And then applicative?
Applicative has a...
Also
an interface, yep. So it's a set of behaviors that a type needs to have in order to be able to say that it's an applicative.
Mm-hmm.
It's related to functors. The category term is actually applicative functor.
Mm-hmm.
So with a functor, you've got a maybe user. With applicative functors, it means that that thing inside can be applied, which means it's a function.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little weird to say, but you might have a maybe, you know, user to string. Mm-hmm. That user to string function is actually inside of the maybe value. So that construct has, it actually has two functions that you have to implement, but I only talk about one of them in the book,
mm-hmm.
And that's called apply. And that basically just lets you take this maybe function mm-hmm. and apply it to a maybe value to get a maybe result.
Mm-hmm. And it's starting to sound a little abstract.
It gets a little hand wavy. It's you know, read the book.
I think
I do a better job there.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's just one of those things where you need to see a lot of examples and kind of live with it for a while.
Yeah, yeah. But it's super useful for parsing is one area where it's used a lot, just because it allows you to write expressions that look like there's no maybe there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got, you know, let's say you've got this user that's made up of a string and an int that represents their name and age.
Mm-hmm.
You would normally make a user just by applying this user function to a string and an int, and mm-hmm. it gives you back a user. Applicative lets you write an expression that looks almost exactly like that, except mm-hmm. it takes as arguments a maybe string and a maybe int,
mm-hmm.
and it gives you back a maybe user.
Right. And so if the name and the age are there, you get back a user, but mm-hmm. if either are not there, you get back a nothing.
Exactly.
But the stuff along the way doesn't really need to care about the maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, again, is beautiful separation of concerns, because mm-hmm. the definition of apply is what worries about the maybe and what handles whether things are there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you just get to write code that shows how to build a user.
Totally. I'm imagining that people listening to this that aren't super familiar with Haskell are probably not quite getting this, and that's mm-hmm. totally like reasonable. Like I spent a lot of time reading the book and understanding it and thinking about it. But it's actually not super complicated when you get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I thought, like with some good examples and a little bit of time, like it was a very understandable concept.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little weird to hear it for the first time, so don't worry if you're not getting it, but it's a reasonable idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to touch on Monad real quick?
Yeah, that leads us into Monad, which is usually the first thing people hear because there's like, you know, that terrible joke about mentioning monads and what is a monad and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when you start with functor and build your way up to applicative, jumping to monad is not that huge of a leap. Mm-hmm. The only difference with monad is that you can, with applicative, when we built that user from those two maybe values, the maybe name and the maybe age, mm-hmm. those sort of, the name and the age kind of went into the user together at once. Mm-hmm. There was no dependency between those two maybe values.
Right, between the name and the age.
Right. So when you sort of upgrade to a monad, you get this ability to depend on other computations. Mm-hmm. So you could have a maybe name or something like that, and you can sort of feed it into a function that depends on what that name value is, mm-hmm. not only whether or not it's there. So you can get the type safety of if you're missing parts of things, you get a nothing result, but you can also actually check what those parts are when they're there. Mm-hmm. Which again, it sounds really confusing, but it's not that bad.
It's not, it really isn't. So what about in general learning Haskell? So this book was kind of my introduction to Haskell. I have read a bit of Learn You a Haskell as mm-hmm. well. Like, where do you see this book, like your stuff falling into the spectrum, and like what order would you?
Yeah,
I mean, someone we're brand new.
It seems a little bold to want to be people's first Haskell book, but mm-hmm. that's kind of where I was aiming it, mm-hmm. Just to sort of give you a taste of the language, yep. show you some cool things, and motivate you to go actually learn it using some other more complete reference.
Mm-hmm. That actually worked pretty well for me. Like the book was pretty much my first exposure, more or less, and I found myself like supplementing a little bit with Learn You a Haskell here and there. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this applicative thing is really cool. I want to read someone else's description of it.
Right.
And just would go like look at that, and like it kind of helped some things click for me.
Yeah, and that's what I've found, at least myself. You know, that's kind of why people sort of talk down of like monad tutorials and things like that as being confusing or yep. you know, weird abstractions. The bottom line is you have to read them all. Like mm-hmm. these abstractions are only going to make sense when you look at them from a lot of different directions.
Totally.
So, you know, read mine, see how mine is, but mm-hmm. make sure you go read others as well.
Yeah, I think it could work as a first Haskell book. I think it actually is a good fit. And it's approachable, right? It's like it's not a long read. And so if you pick up Learn You a Haskell, it's 500 pages or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. But this is like you could get this in a day or two.
Yeah.
Through maybe Haskell. And it's sort of a nice teaser, I guess, in a
yeah.
way. It gives you just enough that's like, wow, this does seem interesting. And that's kind of like when my appreciation for Haskell kicked in, was like after reading your book.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm starting to get the gist of like why this is cool.
Yeah, that's always the hard part when you're really excited about something and you just kind of sound like a lunatic when you're trying to get other people to drink the Kool-Aid.
Right. There were some times where I just like crossed out sentences. It was like, just don't do this.
Yeah.
I know you're excited. Yeah, that's natural though. Let's talk about Haskell or Thoughtbot in general, actually.
Yeah. I've been super lucky in that, you know, people at Thoughtbot are excited about it, mm-hmm. Especially Joe, the CTO, which is always, you know, always great to have a C-level on board.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been doing a lot, and I've been fortunate enough to be a big part of it, mm-hmm. Which is makes me super happy.
So there's been a couple things that we've done that I think sort of like let the Haskell kind of sneak in the back door a little mm-hmm. bit. Like what were those things?
Well, the first thing we did was a reading group to read Learn You a Haskell for Great Good.
Mm-hmm.
And we had had reading groups before, I guess, and it sort of, you know, went up and down in popularity. So Joe decided to bring it back with this book. And I thought it went pretty well. We started with, I want to say, like 8 or 9 people
mm-hmm.
Reading the book together through the first few chapters. And by the end of it, I think we were down to like 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
People sort of dropped off as the material got deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
But it did plant the seed in a few people.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we went from 2 to 4 and then 4 to 6 in terms of interest.
Yep.
And then we started, I think the next thing we did was upcase exercises,
mm-hmm.
Just sort of as a beta internal thing, not released yet. So that was super useful because people need things to write. Like that's the big next step after you read the book mm-hmm. is to not forget the material. You mm-hmm. actually have to sit down and work on a project.
Yeah.
So those exercises were definitely useful for that.
So those were a beta at one point, but now they're out.
They are out now, yes.
Yeah, people can actually do them.
Yes.
So sign up for Upcase.
Yeah, do that.
And do some Haskell. And then there was also Project Night.
Yeah, well, Project Night's actually the most recent thing.
Okay.
Before that, we actually shipped some Haskell.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so we wanted to, you know, evaluate shipping an actual production application for ourselves before looking for client work.
Sure.
So we decided to add comments to our blog as sort of a, you know, third-party Discus-like system that you can just kind of plug in.
Yep.
So we call that Carnival. And that's actually open source, which has been really great because when I have discussions with people about things, I can link them to it. And they can see, you know, real world examples of, you know, actual production web apps mm-hmm. written in Haskell, which is great.
Yep. And that went pretty well.
Yeah.
There was some I remember like the development went well. Deployment was kind of a pain at first.
Yeah. I mean, the Haskell side of things was super easy. You know, it's a JSON API with a JavaScript front end, and that was done relatively quickly.
Yep.
And if we had taken some shortcuts, deployment would have been fine. But we really wanted to see what would happen when we tried to do this using our actual deployment practices,
right?
Which is use CoffeeScript and deploy to Heroku.
Right.
And those two things were the biggest headache out of all of it.
Interesting. It's always the tooling.
I know. So, you know, that was a hassle. We muddled through it. We finally got it done. I would go into the ultimate solution, except that the problem's gotten better since then.
Right.
So
was that from Heroku's work?
That was actually from a project called Halkion and a Haskell on Heroku build pack, which uses Halkion.
Okay.
And I don't know the developer's full name. I know his username is Mietek, M-I-E-T-E-K. And he's just been all over the place developing this thing. Just crazy, crazy effort and
awesome.
Made a really solid tool. So we moved over to that for deployments.
Awesome.
And it's been pretty smooth sailing since then. There's still hiccups here and there, but light years ahead of where we were when we originally launched.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of building a web service with Haskell, you can deploy to Heroku mm-hmm. pretty reasonably.
Yep. Absolutely.
Nice. So that was Carnival.
Mm-hmm.
That was production system number one. There's another one now.
Yeah. You actually just launched one on Upcase.
We did.
It actually worked out pretty well.
So if you're an Upcase user, you are currently running Haskell.
Yeah.
You have some Haskell running in the cloud, as it were.
Yeah. So Joe had this idea, you know, as part of the exercise system, you need to take in diffs of users' exercises.
Right.
And parse them and display them back. Mm-hmm. And Joe had written this code in Ruby and found that it was the biggest source of bugs.
Right.
The code was hard to follow. There was a lot of edge case bugs. And with parsing being a known good use case for Haskell.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to see if we could extract a small service just to handle diff parsing.
Right.
Take in the raw text and spit out some structured JSON of what that diff is.
Right.
And we quickly found out that there was already a library for parsing diffs in Haskell, so we weren't even going to get to write that.
Mm.
But we did wrap it up in a web service, which went very smoothly. And when did you guys launch that?
Like 2 days ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's out there now.
Yeah, so it's live in production. The interesting thing was, so the Ruby version uses about 250 megs of memory,
mm-hmm.
and the Haskell one uses 2.
Yeah.
And returns in about 5 milliseconds.
Yeah.
It's really fast. It's kind of awesome that you can write this really crazy high-level safe language, and then it's really fast.
Yeah.
And resource usage is really reasonable.
Absolutely. Yeah, the optimizations that the compiler can do when you're writing pure code is incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So there's 2 systems in production. I know that we haven't like announced this like in a huge way, but we're looking to do a project in Haskell.
Yes.
Actually, I'm announcing it here on the podcast.
Oh, boy.
So if you want us to come write you some Haskell, or not come, but if you want to come to us and have us write you some Haskell, we have production experience. We got a guy that wrote a book. We're looking to like make this thing happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that would be that's sort of the next step, right?
Is like, yes, you know, that's our big next thing.
Get paid to do it.
Yep.
That's when it becomes a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are a handful of problems that are really good fits mm-hmm. for Haskell, right? So like parsing stuff, for instance,
yeah.
if you need that performance. But it's also sort of a generally useful language, so it almost doesn't even need to be especially
No, it definitely
tailored.
Doesn't. I think personally, and I don't speak for the company, but I think personally it's more about finding the right client than it is the right project.
Yep.
So we need a client that either does not care at all what we build something in
mm-hmm.
or is actively open and excited to the idea of using, you know, a newer, better, well, it's not a newer language, but a newer idea anyway,
mm-hmm.
Using Haskell in production like this and sees the things that we see in yeah. it as the benefits.
Yeah. So if that's you or you know someone like that, then get in touch. Email Pat at ThoughtBot.
Yep.
And we'll take care of you.
Absolutely.
So you've done some, there's one other thing I think that contributed to the sort of Haskell at ThoughtBot renaissance, which we're enjoying right now, which was Swift.
Yes.
That contributed a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once Swift got announced and, you know, the functional ideas in there, I had sort of a whole new batch of people to yell at about Haskell.
Mm-hmm.
Our iOS guys are our biggest sort of Haskell enthusiasts.
Right. Which was interesting to see.
Yeah.
It's kind of like good luck and good timing.
Yeah.
That these guys suddenly needed to know about, you know, optional values and things mm-hmm. like that. And so it just, there's a fair amount of overlap in with Haskell.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been really fun to see Tony and Gordon re-implement Haskell libraries in Swift. Like they have Argo, which is their JSON parsing library that's pretty much directly modeled after ASIN, the Haskell version, and uses applicative functors to handle the parsing. Yep. And that seems to have been well received. I guess the community is a little split on whether they're on board with these sort of further down the functional road ideas.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I'm into it. I vote yes.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so that was a nice a boon there.
Yeah.
So you've done some Haskell open source stuff yourself.
I have.
Some YesO. Does that start your biggest amount of batch of contributions, would you say?
I would say, yeah. I started using YesO when it was really early on, when it was like 0.1. Uh-huh. The early days were pretty rough because he was not worried about breaking changes.
Sure.
So having a blog written using early versions of YesO, every update was craziness.
YesO is a web framework.
Yes, probably should say that.
Yeah.
It's like the Rails of Haskell, basically. Mm-hmm. There are a couple web frameworks in Haskell. I'm not familiar with any of them other than YesO, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I do know that YesO is the sort of bigger, does more things for you version than others, like Snap would be more like Sinatra, whereas YesO is more like Rails.
Gotcha.
And it was super easy to get involved. You know, the developer, Michael Snyman, was always open to, you know, looping people in. And it's like after one PR, he like adds you to the organization. So now I'm, you know, in there with commit access, which is great.
That's cool.
So it's been really easy to just not only sort of the modularity of Haskell makes it really easy to write libraries on top of YesO. Like I wrote a markdown library or a pagination library, things like that. But it's also really easy to just get in and do a little commit here or there to add a function or improve docs or whatever. So I've got a bunch of stuff like that out there.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things actually about smaller language communities is like what we're seeing with the Swift guys is like, A, there are places for you that there are needs that have not been filled and you kind of like just port tools over like, hey, we had this nice thing in Ruby. Like, I wish I had this over here. We had this nice thing in Haskell. Like, we should just put this in, make this happen in Swift. And also, I feel like your contributions have a greater impact.
Yeah.
Like percentage wise, it's like, oh, you contribute to like the main web framework in Haskell and suddenly like it benefits.
Yeah. Know? And it's really great to be. Like, you get to be that person to write the markdown library. Like, you can't do that in Rails now. There's, like, 37 markdown libraries already out there. So that's really awesome. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, you have to write the markdown library.
That's true.
You know?
So, yeah. How do you find the library, like, situation in Haskell in general?
I think it's great. I've yet to not be able to find what I need. It's very hard to we found that diff parser. I did not expect that to exist, but there it was. It worked well. It was well tested. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't support like two use cases, so we added that. But you know, other than that, it was pretty much ready to go.
Did you guys submit a PR for that?
Yep.
Kind of
yep. Oh, nice. And the guy was super, super active. Merged it like within a day.
Very cool.
Really, really good experience.
That's awesome. So one of the things I'm noticing, like as I read more Haskell now, is like the fact that all the functions are annotated with types. Mm-hmm. I find it easier to understand the code, because it's sort of, there's like a nice like high level description of everything in the system. Do you find it easier to like pick up a new library or pick up and like contribute to something existing because of that?
I do. I think that because Haskell's purely functional and functions can't do anything that's not explicit in the type signature, you can totally understand a function just from its type signature. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people say that Haskell's lacking in documentation. But I don't really believe that because I look at the Haddix, which are automatically generated documentation that at a minimum just shows you type signatures. You can also add explanatory comments and things like that. But even if I look at, you know, API documentation that just says type signatures, like I know pretty much everything I need to know to use this library.
Right. And unlike a Ruby library where you could have documentation which says like promises this method takes of this and does of that, like, you know, it actually is accurate. It's up to date. Cannot fall out of date.
Absolutely.
Because the compiler checks it for you.
Yep.
Which is kind of beautiful.
It's pretty great.
Sort of having like that like moment of like, yeah, type systems. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, have the compiler check things for you instead of you doing it.
Yep.
Kind of awesome. Cool. Any parting thoughts on Haskell or any of the stuff we talked about?
No, I wish I had something profound to say, but...
But come on in, the water's fine.
Yeah, really.
Personally, I've been really enjoying like reading and writing Haskell lately. So
I'm appreciative of that.
Yeah, so I think other people should check it out too.
Yeah.
And it took a little while to learn. Like it does take some effort, but it's doable.
Mm-hmm.
It's reasonable. It's approachable, and I'm liking this new sort of vocabulary I have of like ways of thinking about how functional programming works.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like it's going to impact some of my other stuff, like Clojure, because it's also a functional language,
yep.
And probably even Ruby because it's got some functional bits in there too. Yep. So. I recommend it as an exercise for people. If you're looking for a language that's unlike the one you're using now, like if you're a Ruby person, give Haskell a try.
Absolutely.
It'll blow your mind a little bit. Awesome. So where can people get this book should they want to?
It's pretty easy. MaybeHaskell.com. It's hyphenated, so maybe-haskell.com.
Okay. Also, as a special gift to you, our wonderful and beautiful and talented and intelligent podcast listeners, we're going to offer you 50% off Pat's book if you'd like to pick it up. There is a special link in the show notes, which if you click it, will apply a discount, and you should totally get the book because it's awesome. So today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/137. Thanks for listening.